Welcome to the Chronically Online podcast, where we will be discussing our communicative encounters both digitally and physically. And I'm going to introduce our first topic on semiotic modes and media.
Semiotics is a very important aspect of digital communications, especially in terms of multimodality and looking at different forms of communication. I think the most important thing to consider first is what actually is multimodality. So in the context of digital communication, it's the use of multiple modes or forms of communication within digital platforms or landscapes. These modes not only include written or spoken languages, but also images, videos, hyperlinks, sound animations, and so on. And within digital communication, people will usually engage with a combination of these modes simultaneously to convey or interpret certain meanings. So essentially, the concept of multimodality emphasizes the importance of considering the interplay between different modes in understanding digital texts and interactions. Adami explores this in detail and talks about how combining images, speech, writing, and gestures and text is important to consider, and how each mode has unique features shaped by social and material context where they work together to create meanings. A good and relevant example of this is the type of social media platforms people may use in terms of, do they text people? Do they use voice memos? Do they send videos? Do they send photos? And even the type of social media they're on. So whether they're on TikTok, Snapchat, Instagram, those can have their own meanings. And this relates to the idea of how this goes into social meanings of multimodal text, which leads to allowing for more critical interpretations, which can reveal ideologies and social values. Another important thing to consider is modes. And essentially, modes are just different channels or forms of communication that are utilized to convey certain meanings. With all this considered, why is multimodal analysis important when thinking about digital communication? It brings forward the idea of modes having to be analyzed with the consideration of other modes. Modes are always interacting with each other, and participants within a communicative exchange have the opportunity to potentially bring another type of mode into the foreground, which can drastically affect meaning potentials. Jones has a really interesting example of this in play, where he talks about an AIDS prevention advertisement, which was sent out in Brazil. And essentially, they use images from very different contexts. So they used images based around biology and a medicinal discourse, and they paired them with labels that related to video game vocabulary, which related to video game discourse, to construct a message around AIDS prevention, especially with certain labels and words such as, you only have one life, use a condom, to sort of add context. So that's a great example of how words, images can be used together to create certain meanings within certain contexts. Okay, so have you guys had any interactions where you or someone else has used specific modes in a certain context to convey certain meanings? I think what I talked about in my log was when Just Stop Oil came to campus and they did that whole thing like with the Great Hall, and how like it was like a really serious issue about like climate change, and someone posted it on their Snapchat story. And I just thought it was interesting how, because it was like posted on Snapchat with like, I think they posted it and then they put laughing emojis with it. And it was just like the context of, oh, it's like a serious cause, a serious situation. But because it was like posted on someone's Snapchat story with laughing emojis, it was kind of turned into a meme in a way. So that the change of context.
So what I wrote in my logs were about the exchanges I have with my friends using emojis, and just how there's an emoji for like virtually everything now, like, and like they convey different meanings. The heart shape is its own thing because it doesn't look like an actual heart, but you can depict it and like you know exactly what it means and you know what it conveys. And so when you receive it from a friend, you know it's meant in a loving way. And how like shape and shapes in emojis can shape a message so much.
It reminds me of like, I don't know if you guys had the same thing, like it's not a thing now, but when I was younger, like the color of the heart that someone sent you was like important. So like if, yeah, it was literally a red heart, it was like a love heart, or if it was like a blue heart, it was like a friend heart.
Well, in terms of modes, could you say like an instant message is something like that's more casual, but like using an email, yeah, is kind of more, yeah, formal, especially, I mean, in the workplace especially, is kind of like you send an email as like a formal way of communication, especially with customers.
That was very insightful. I'm now going to introduce linguistic repertoires.
Hi, so what I specialise in is linguistic repertoires, and it sounds kind of complex at first, and like, don't get me wrong, it is, but essentially, linguistic repertoires looks into the study of the countless languages or linguistic varieties that individuals and communities adopt and use in conversation. So, for example, a person may be born in France, have Italian parents, watch American TV, use social media platforms like TikTok, where all of these new phrases are coined, and will then inevitably end up with a rather unique linguistic repertoire. So really, it's all about the why. It's actually a really interesting concept to grasp when you think about it, because we are surrounded by such a mixture of linguistic repertoires. It's like, to have the exact same linguistic repertoire as someone else, you'd have to have the same background as them, grow up in the same area, speak to the same people, watch the same things, and that's just so unlikely. However, to be able to truly grasp this concept, you first need to be able to distinguish between a language, a dialect, and an accent. So consider, traditionally, a language is described as such because of its differing structure of codes, making it not mutually intelligible, whereas dialect is described as such because it is mutually intelligible and instead differs in areas of vocabulary and grammar. And then inside of a dialect, you have an accent where it differs in pronunciation. So think, there is American English and London English, where they both share the English language, but then you have Americans who call it soccer and England who call it football, which would be because of their different dialect. And then in each country, they have multiple accents. For example, in America, there's Texan, Valley Girl, New Yorkian, etc. And then in England, you have Geordie, Scouse, London, etc. And there's a really interesting study that a man called Ben Rampton did, which was then documented by Horner and Weber, where he visited a small town in South Midlands of England and was said to have found examples of white and Asian adolescents using Caribbean Creole, black and white adolescents using Punjabi, and all of them stylizing Asian English. And I have here Rampton's evaluation where he states, Creole was widely seen as cool, tough, and good to use. It was associated with assertiveness, verbal resourcefulness, competence in heterosexual relationships, and opposition to authority. It was scarcely represented at all in the official school curriculum, and it occupied a dominant position in popular music and performance youth culture. So for the moment, I'd like us to focus on that last part where he distinguishes a relation between linguistics and a dominant position in popular music and performance of youth culture, because I think it's so relevant to youth culture right now, with apps like TikTok and Instagram fueling our entertainment and essentially creating a new form of dialect for today's youth to follow. For example, did you know last year the word Riz was awarded Oxford Dictionary's Word of the Year? And that started out as a random person's abbreviation of the word charisma. I just find it insane how, because of how accessible these things are as a form of pop culture and entertainment, the way in which we communicate with others can be altered. Does anyone have any of their own kind of experiences with these linguistic traits?
I think it's really interesting with the TikTok thing, because me and my friends from like uni started saying the word slay a lot last year after that started popping off a bit on TikTok. And if it wasn't for TikTok kind of language and Instagram's kind of like simplified use of language and words, I don't think we would have really started saying slay 24/7 like we do, and that's really embedded itself within our vernacular, which it wouldn't have if it wasn't like for TikTok and Instagram fueling that.
No, yeah, I had like an interaction with my little brother, and we were talking about, he did like a climbing competition, and he was talking about how there's like loads of sweats, and I think sweats is like video game language, and he was like talking to me about it, and I think my mom was there, and she was like, what is a sweat? And she was like, so confused. We had to like explain to her where it's someone who like tries really hard at something.
There's a lot of words, especially with kind of my grandparents, they kind of don't understand any of the lingo. I kind of have to talk to them and explain to it, especially nowadays. Well, apps like TikTok, where it's predominantly young people who are on them, and they're kind of impressionable. They do pick up stuff quite easily. So I kind of have to help them and explain kind of certain things to them to help them kind of understand.
Just taking it back to Rampton's study, I'd like to now focus on his note about how Creole was never spoken in the school curriculum, because this was also discussed in Horner and Weber in 2018, who investigated the concept of the standard British language as the expectation, despite there being multiple forms of dialect across Britain. They essentially asked the question of what makes this the standard. In my opinion, as someone who was taught standard British in school, this is such an overlooked topic. On a small scale, there's an example of me and many others from Birmingham being taught to pronounce our T's, otherwise we would not be speaking correctly. And on a much larger scale, there's the monolingual ideology of language elitism. You know, you see children and parents travel to England from other countries and instantly being taught English, but no one bothering to learn their native languages. For example, in school, I had a lot of Polish friends who were immediately given separate English lessons when joining the school. And then they'd tell me about the quote unquote struggle faced by their parents due to the prejudgment and elitist mentality that their lesser knowledge of English equates to lesser intelligence, rather than appreciating and acknowledging the fact that they're equipped in multiple languages. So Horner and Weber implemented this in their text by posing the scenario. Imagine you're a teacher of English. Would you mark the following sentences as correct or incorrect? And so I'm going to tell you the examples and I want to know what you think. So A, we've got, I'm after eating my lunch. Do you think that's correct or incorrect English?
I would personally say that sounds incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'd say incorrect.
Incorrect, surely.
And then, so example B is, I ain't got no money.
I think it could be correct.
I'd say correct.
I think the same thing. Yeah, I'd say mm-hmm. correct.
And then C is, the teacher used to chalk. Is that correct or incorrect?
Surely that's correct.
Yeah, surely I would say that's say correct. Correct.
Well, actually, what's interesting about this is Horner and Weber went on to say that all three are incorrect in standard British English, but they are correct in other vernacular varieties of English. So A being an Irish English, B being an African-American English, and C being an Indian English. And I think this is such a good way to describe the monolingual ideology, showing the individuality between different communities. The dominant ideology attempts to strip us of our individuality.
That was also very insightful. And now I'm going to introduce you to digital communications, communities, spaces, and practices.
And I'm delving into the dynamic world of digital communities, spaces, and practices. Let's start by defining what we mean by digital communities. Digital communities are virtual spaces where individuals with shared interests, goals, or identities come together to interact, share knowledge, and support one another. These communities can range from social media groups to online forums, gaming platforms, and professional networks. Digital communities come in various forms. Some are based on hobbies and interests, like cooking, photography, or gaming. Others revolve around professional fields, such as technology, healthcare, or marketing. There are also communities centered on personal development, activism, and support groups. What makes digital communities unique is its key features. Accessibility. Digital communities transcend geographical boundaries, allowing individuals from around the world to connect. Diversity. These communities bring together people from diverse backgrounds, fostering rich exchanges of ideas and perspectives. Collaboration. Members often collaborate on projects, share resources, and offer mutual support. And identity expression, where digital communities provide a platform for individuals to express their identities and find belonging. Over the years, digital spaces have evolved rapidly, driven by advancements in technology and changing users' behavior. From the early days of internet forums to the rise of social media networks and the emergence of virtual reality platforms, digital spaces continue to evolve, offering new ways for people to connect and engage. Digital communities have a profound impact on individuals, organizations, and society as a whole. They facilitate learning, innovation, and collaboration, empower marginalized voices, and provide crucial support networks for individuals facing challenges. However, digital communities also face challenges, such as maintaining inclusivity, ensuring that digital communities are inclusive and welcoming to individuals from all backgrounds, addressing toxic behavior, combating harassment, bullying, and other forms of toxic behavior within digital spaces, privacy and security, protecting members' privacy and data security in an era of increasing online threats. James Paul G discusses the notion community and how one can define what a community is, especially in terms of a digital community. He questions on how a community can be formed and labeled. For example, he discusses people who are within a semiotic social space, such as social media spaces, online video games, etc., and by how them interacting with each other is creating a community. Do you, any of you guys have an example of a digital community you're part of? My example of a digital community is playing an online video game, such as Call of Duty. The online community is built surrounding the game with the shared interest of playing the game. People from around the world can interact with one another online through different social media platforms, through in-game, and through playing with each other.
Yeah, I've got a digital community that I would probably say that I'm a part of. So on TikTok, there's kind of different subcategories of spaces that you can kind of be a part of. And very popular one is BookTok, because I read a lot. I'll often look for that hashtag to find new book recommendations, to see what people think about the books that I've read and whether I agree with their reviews. I'll often interact in the BookTok space by sending a video to my friend who also interacts with BookTok quite a bit. It's a digital space that I would say I'm a part of within TikTok.
Yeah, I guess you could say it's like a group of people who are like really interested in like the outdoors and like hiking and stuff. And it's kind of like book talk in a way, but it's called Gorpcore and hiking. And it's kind of similar in the sense that there's loads of videos that like I share with friends that we interact with in terms of like where we want to go, like if we want to go camping, that like help organize like certain trips and stuff, which is really cool.
Yeah, I guess it kind of, they all kind of foster an opportunity for you to talk to other people who have that shared interest, because they kind of all, yeah, they give you that opportunity that maybe you wouldn't have if you weren't part. But it's quite hard, because in the reading he talks about whether you can class that as a community or not. Like, yeah, he discusses saying that like a group of people in a project in a classroom, he discusses whether that's a community and kind of how you can put a label on that community. So it's quite hard, kind of, because there's so many different, like, so broad in terms of digital communication. Like, how can you label something a community?
And I'm going to be diving into our final topic of the Chronically Online podcast. This topic is cultural and intercultural communication. So what is culture? Culture is a social aspect of human life, the threads that weave us together in unique and meaningful ways. Culture is common behavioural patterns in group, and essentially culture is anything which is learned or made by humans. Groups who share religious beliefs, practice rituals and ceremonies form culture, as does the tangible, the objects and symbols made by culture to give meaning. Cultural expression can be made through art, music, literature, dance and more. Cultural practices are ways of making meaning and communicating, and Adami explains that in specific situations, cultural practices encompass a sharedness or, on the flip side, non-sharedness by dynamics and relations. With cultural practice comes issues such as essentialism and small and large cultures. Small and large cultures is a concept proposed by Adrian Holliday in order to understand the complexities of culture and its influence on intercultural interactions. Small culture encompasses any cohesive social grouping without subordination to large cultures, whereas large cultures is essentialist as it focuses on the essential differences between ethnic, national and ideational entities. In intercultural communication, the concept of rich points determines that there are verbal and nonverbal expressions, where only the group of people within that cultural community understand. A rich point can be people who are interested in swimming, as they share a culture. The term medley relay, which is race and swimming, can be a rich point. Countries highlights the huge areas of cultural differences. I am an English-Irish woman who has grown up entirely overseas in the Middle East and China, and I've seen how these can, as Argus states, generate more rich points than others. In my international school, we had over 65 nationalities present in the student body. With that came many different regional cultures and languages. I speak English, and my friend who is Chilean spoke Spanish, and had a small grasp on English. As I had never lived in the UK, regardless of it being my home country, quote unquote, I did not have much to offer on the traditions and cultural environment there. Compared to my friend, who I shall call M for Nomity, wanted to share the traditions and rituals of Chile to me. But we struggled with a language barrier. However, we both love sport, specifically football. So we would share our fantasy Premier League teams and share our interests there. We rarely had any barriers to our conversation, indicating a cultural thread. When one cannot access or relate to a culture, certain aspects and cultural experiences can promote difficulties in grasping the concepts. For instance, the stereotype perpetuated on Chinese culture. When my family in the UK asked me about living in China, the assumption that I had eaten a dog or that all Chinese people eat dog was always brought up. This is a cultural block. Cultural blocks are a very essentialist view. Phillips argues that essentialism attributes certain characteristics to everyone within a category, which often naturalizes or exhibits socially constructed traits and policing collective categories by treating shared characteristics as defining, inhibiting questions or modification without challenging one's belonging to the group. Thank you for listening to the Chronically Online podcast. We hope you have got some newfound insights into digital communication, specifically in semiotics and media, linguistic repertoires, digital communities, and intercultural communication.